Nothing in this program should be considered investment advice. It is for educational purposes only. Please hit pause and read this disclaimer in full.
If this thing cracks and the government prints enough money to where inflation is sustained, there's going to be a lot of forced liquidations of portfolios and people's retirements. The vision that they have retirement is going to turn into a nightmare because they're not going to have time to recover from it.
The following is the audio version of a video released at peakprosperity.com. Visit peakprosperity.com to watch the video and to find other insightful content such as articles, discussion forums, and exclusive subscriber-only content.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to this episode of Finance U. We're back with Paul Kiker of Kiker Wealth Management. Hey, Paul, how are you doing?
Hi, Chris. I'm doing well. Good to see you again today.
Yeah, a lot is happening in the markets right now. At the time of this recording, we're seeing Bitcoin has just broken below 90,000. And of course, there's some side damage with stocks like MSTR, which is a leveraged bet on Bitcoin. So we'll see how that plays out. But there's a big rollover going on in AI. The AI story has taken some couple of black eyes these last couple of weeks. It was all exciting. And it was all pie in the sky, sky's the limit, no limit, exponential growth. But I want to talk about that. I want to talk about M2, and which is a broad measure of money. This is exploding globally. I think that explains a lot of the frothiness we've been seeing. Housing in the U.S. and then layoffs. That's sort of what's on my plate for today. Anything on your plate?
No, I'll follow your lead. So,
well, for most people listening, obviously, you know, whither goes housing is like a big, big thing, because if you're trying to buy a house, obviously you want the prices to come down, right? That'd be nice. But if you own a house, it's kind of like little ambivalent, right? Like, you don't want your house to fall in price necessarily, but at the same time, in my case, my property taxes are keyed off of the assessed value. So I actually have a pretty compelling, I want to see my house price fall. I'd like to pay less property taxes. And yes. And so I do think this is going to create some difficulties, but now they say Nick Gehrle, who you and I both love for his real estate stuff, Zillow reporting 50% of houses in the U.S. experienced a declining Zestimate over the last 12 months. So that's 53%. So that's more than half now. It's a big deal.
Yeah, that is a big deal, but it's not surprising to me at all based on what I'm hearing around the country of what's taking place in different markets. And of course, there's some markets that are holding up well, but that's not surprising at all to me. And I think it's just getting started because people are frozen. They're refusing to drop their prices and the market's frozen. And all it takes is for those forced sellers to start, and then it's going to be gain some acceleration.
Well, yeah, you know, some people have the luxury, right, of just saying, well, I'll just wait this out. But other people have to sell. And if you have to sell and it's not selling, the reason is the price is too high. So it's not that complicated of a thing. I know it's difficult emotionally, but if you want to sell your house, the advice is drop your price.
Yes, yes. And I actually have had some conversations lately with individuals that are like, hey, I want to get out of these properties for whatever reason. Some has to do with where they are in retirement. They don't want to have to deal with them anymore. They've been on the market for quite some time, kind of priced with everyone. And the question was like, what do I do to move this? And I said, well, drop the price, right? If you're going to drop the price, that increases activity, and you got to get to the point where you get enough activity and offers in there. And you know, some markets were a little more than others, but that helped these individuals move their homes that they were ready to get out of.
As you mentioned, you know, some markets doing better than others, some doing worse. Also from Nick Gehrle, it turns out that Florida, not just Palm Beach, Florida as a state, condo values are down 9.9% in the last 12 months. So that's pretty big. 9 months of supply, more declines next year are likely. I know there's other issues going on, and we'll get to this. I want to tie it in because, of course, insurance costs for homes have become unaffordable or even unobtainable in Florida. And condos down there have some special issues, too, because there was some issue, I think. I don't totally know what it was, but it was something about the management fees were starting to just really spike, particularly in certain counties, for a variety of reasons. So they became on it. But this, you know, the whole thing behind this was these were just supposed to be a surefire investment, you know, and here we are. We're now down in an area we haven't seen since 2009.
Mm-hmm.
So,
and that's a slap in the face for the people that convinced themselves that there were houses were underbuilt, supply was underbuilt, and everybody north was going to move to Florida. Right.
Yep. But it's those insurance costs which are really spiking in. And let me cut ahead to that because I had that in here. I have an aha moment for you. You ready?
Yes.
Aha. Because you and I have been talking about it. Like, why are insurance costs spiking so much for auto insurance, home insurance, health insurance? And you and I had speculated that maybe they took their premium money and put it into some dodgy stuff mm-hmm. that's maybe not doing so well. Surprise. It turns out private credit is 35% of total U.S. insurers' investments.
35%? Boy, they were sold something hard. Wow,
yeah.
35%.
That's crazy. Look what the Moody's survey of insurers' average positions in private credit instruments is 35% of total, and they're in commercial real estate is a big chunk of that. Private placements could be all kinds of things there. Residential mortgages, infrastructure, money market lending, and asset-based finance, fund finance, and other. Wow. There's a lot of dog meat in that pile right there right now.
Yeah, that just verifies some of the concerns that we had in there, because the commercial lending, and you think about all these office properties that we've talked about over the past year, I mean, to an extent, it got boring to talk about because it's been going on for so long that they're selling for 10 and 20 cents on the dollar. Were there loans behind that? And there's some absorption. And our indication that that was a possibility of where these increased premiums were coming from seems to be verified by that data right there.
Yep. And if I was a state regulator on any of this, Paul, you know, an insurance regulator, I would say, listen, you took some outsized risks, didn't pan out. Before I allow you to even begin to think about raising rates, you're going to have zero profits, right? You're going to have to make whatever equity holders you have eat something here, right?
Mm-hmm.
And we're going to need to see you, like, lay people off or trim your CEO's budget. I would say, listen, there ought to be consequences, not just like, oh, we had a bad run. Let's make the rate payers pay more. I think there should be consequences for this. That's how I would roll. But
I agree 100%. But the problem is, just like we found out with the Tricolor fraud situation with the rehypothecation of all those auto loans that they had, you know, these politicians are elected because they're nice people, not because they're the most brilliant individuals on the face of the earth. And I'm not saying they're all nice people. I'm just talking about that's, you know, what most people look for. Oh, I like that person. I'll vote for him. Without paying attention to how diligent they are or how skilled they are or experienced within that industry. So they're getting lobbyists that are coming to them say, oh, we got to raise our premiums because the hurricane was horrible. Well, the hurricane was horrible, but that's what you have reserves for. That's what you're supposed to set it aside for.
Mm-hmm.
And just like what took place under the service and we're finding popping up all over the place with these frauds, there's no due diligence on their part to hold these insurers accountable. So they don't know because they don't want to know. They're just not being diligent at their job, and that's what they're supposed to do. They're elected to be a fiduciary to protect us as the insured and hold the insurance companies accountable. So I agree. Yeah, if you're a CEO and you've made bad investments, you shouldn't make a penny if you're not replaced. And whoever comes in shouldn't be making anywhere near the compensation that they're making right now in relation. And yeah, they shouldn't have any profits, and their shareholders should pay some price for that.
Indeed, indeed. And this, you know, I was talking with my friend Ken McElroy a few years back, and he had looked at 600 real estate deals that year and only did one, right? And he's a pro, right? Been doing this for decades, been on both sides of the business, both from the property management and then the developer side and the owner side, right? So he knows it as well as anybody. I said, well, what happened? You know, he said, the numbers just didn't add up that year. And I said, well, what happened? He said, well, the dumb money showed up. I was like, who's the dumb money? He said insurance companies were coming in and grabbing deals at a 3% cap rate. He's like, goodness. I won't touch these for anything under 5. And these guys and gals were busy bidding this stuff up at 3. And I guess their thinking was, this was back when there was still some ZERP. So they're like, well, do we have 0.75% on a 10-year? 3% sounds tasty. He said, but they were dumb. They didn't understand that you will lose money at a 3% cap rate on real estate. It's just pretty much very difficult not to, you know, get skinned when you're down there, because your margins are razor thin, you know, on that deal. And all you need is a hailstorm or whatever, or a little more occupancy, you know, decline than you thought. It doesn't take much, right?
Right,
But he called them dumb money, and now I'm thinking, well, that was maybe a little harsh, and I'm looking at this, and I'm like, maybe not harsh enough.
Yeah. Well, one thing about Ken is he has a strategy. He understands its limits, and he's disciplined enough to stick to it. That's one of the reasons why he's the Warren Buffett of real estate, if I could say from his side. And, you know, and another thing, he has skin in the game. Yeah, I think he does have investor money, mm-hmm. but he's got a large portion of his net worth tied to the outcome. A lot of these individuals that are employees of the insurance companies, they don't have skin in the game. They're just flush with cash at this point, so they're mm-hmm. deploying that capital anywhere that somebody's promising this great return, and all they're looking at is hindsight, so they're operating off a hindsight bias, and it's the insurers that are paying the price because the regulators aren't holding them accountable for what they're doing, because most, what I believe, they don't even know, because they're not diligent enough to go be excellent at what they do to dig under the surface.
Well, you have to be excellent at a lot of stuff here to be investing in everything from asset-based finance, fund finance, commercial real estate, private placements. I mean, that, you know, every one of those requires due diligence and expertise. And we just found out, didn't we, that even BlackRock failed to do basic due diligence on a $500 million loan that was a total scam mm-hmm. on a telecom deal, and then another thing that went bad on them. That's just sort of sign of the froth when you see that kind of stuff there. 35%, right?
Oh, that's huge.
That's a big number.
And that's the sign of the complacency. And that's a belief that the Fed's going to bail us out so we don't have to be diligent in here, because they're going to take care of us and they're not going to let anything go wrong. And they're not God, that's for sure.
Well, they're not. And look at Asia Pacific. They have, I'm going to call that 6%-ish, maybe 7. Mm-hmm. That's okay. You know, you want to nibble at the edge on a portfolio basis, 6-7%. I could make a case for that. But 35%, I'm pushing half my stack on red, you know? That's a bet.
Oh yeah. That's a bet. That's a speculative bet. That's a heavy bet.
Where the ratepayers end up paying, right? That's when you find out about like people's auto insurance spiking. And that's a big theme I'm running into a lot right now is people are just getting squeezed every possible which way, you know, and our state is just thinking of new creative ways to tax people more, right? Mm-hmm. Because they're also getting a little tight. Because again, I would suggest personally, I think they've been a little frivolous with where they've decided to put, my state committed $10 billion with a B dollars to putting mega battery packs in for green energy, right? Where if they got all of that done, it'll supply our state for 4 minutes. Of backup power.
You could
build like 3 gas-fired power plants and actually make electricity, you know. Anyway, it's just, but we're going to pay for that.
It comes back and here's another thing. So you get Trump, who comes in, he's wanting to private equity for 401ks, right? So let's just take the other side of that. These big insurance companies, we've heard stories about Harvard's endowment and some issues that they have with illiquidity in their private equity investments. So now you've got these big insurers that have speculated in this area. We're starting to see troubles. So they've got massive amount of resources to go lobby these politicians to try to offload it on somebody else. So not only are they increasing these premiums to cover for their mistakes, which is what I believe, I don't know that to be a fact, that's evidence that shows that that's taking place right now. But now they're using the dollars that were given to them, I would assume, to go out and use that lobbying power to create another market, lower the entry point, and let's offload this on the citizenry. It's just not right. They're serving themselves instead of serving the people like they should.
Yeah. Now, have you seen this? I just ran across this today. This is the first time I saw it. But in black is the S&P 500, and in red are S&P listed private equity index companies. And you can clearly see that the private equity is falling, just almost coincident with the time Trump came out and said, why don't we open this up to you know, private investors, 401ks, all of that. And I personally know people who are getting calls from private bankers saying, yeah, you should get into private equity. It's so exciting. and it's busy sneaking out the back door. This is the oldest story in the Wall Street book, isn't it, Paul?
Mm-hmm.
As soon as, like they're not calling you with a great deal because there's a lot of room left to run on that story.
No.
Yeah.
When they see huge opportunity, it takes 2 million plus to get in, or 1 million plus. You know, it's got it's larger numbers. And when it gets to the point that they don't see much opportunity, they'll lower it down to 25,000 or 50,000 to get in when they're these big companies.
Yep.
And they're just trying to offload. They're trying to free up their capital so that they have money when everybody else doesn't.
Indeed. When we come back, Paul, I want to talk about AI because we got a lot going on there. I think the blush is off that rose. So we'll be right back after this message. Markets are facing heightened uncertainty, and thoughtful portfolio management has never been more important. If your current strategy relies solely on passive investing or diversification without active oversight, it may be time to consider a different approach. At Peak Financial Investing, we connect you with experienced wealth managers who actively manage portfolios using disciplined, research-driven strategies designed to adapt to evolving market conditions. Our focus is on helping clients navigate volatility with clarity and confidence. While no investment strategy can guarantee results or eliminate risk, we believe that preparation and active management can make a meaningful difference over time. Visit peakfinancialinvesting.com to schedule a complimentary consultation and explore whether our approach aligns with your goals. I'm Dr. Chris Martinson, and I am proud to support Peak Financial Investing. This is not a guarantee of future performance, but a call to take your financial planning seriously. Again, that's peakfinancialinvesting.com. Investing, of course, involves risk, including the potential loss of principal. Past performance is not indicative of future results. Please consult with a qualified advisor before making investment decisions. All right, welcome back, everybody. Paul, we were just talking about private equity, private credit. And by the way, part of that story is you've been hearing it, I'm sure, these AI companies have been saying, we just need $1 trillion of capital, and but they don't quite know where they're going to get it from. And so they've been saying, maybe it comes from pensions, maybe it comes from 401ks, but they're going to have to tap a huge pools of capital to get there. And we've seen the companies themselves, and again, any company I talk about today, Paul, it's neither recommendation for or against, but like Meta and the amount of debt they're taking on. So if you look at the free cash flows that they actually have left, not what their income statement says, but their free cash flows are just getting hammered because investment is, it comes out of cash, right? Mm-hmm. Typically. So they're levering up on debt, cash flows are coming down, and it's just this big, giant roll the dice on AI, and still nobody has a clear idea where the revenues are going to come from. That's how I see the story currently.
Right. And I see it the same way. And look, I know it has some value. Artificial intelligence note taking has made us more efficient. There are many things that's made it more efficient. And technically, efficiency can help profitability from a longer term standpoint, but this hasn't been just absolutely revolutionary at this point. It's a supercharged search engine in most cases, unless you do what China's doing, and they've been specializing in the manufacturing process at this point, which is incredibly profitable. That they seem to have deviated from this one ring to rule them all scenario with easy money that's taken place in the United States. And it's a risky bet.
Well, it is. I think our strategy, if I could sum it up here in the U.S., is we're going to just have more data centers than anybody. This is a compute power story. If we have more compute power, we're going to win the race. And the race presumably is that AI pops through some magic membrane and does something. I don't know what. Can dominate your enemies, make you so far ahead of the AI race, nobody can catch up. China, for whatever reason, has looked at all of that and said, nah. So I understand that they're pursuing open source models like DeepSeek. They're trying to make the things hyper efficient. So we're over here betting that we're going to have this dominating edge and people are going to pay trillions for access to it. And they're betting we can make this open source and it should be sort of just scalable and cheap for everybody. Weird. I would have flipped those two things 10 years ago. I would have said China's going to pursue the command and control angle, and the United States would pursue the open source model. But go figure, right? Who's the communist now? I don't know.
No kidding. Well, there's such a monopolistic bent within the United States now. It seems like everybody wants to have a monopoly the government doesn't talk about monopolies anymore. They don't seem to try to protect the citizenry about it. But I was having a hard time understanding that. But Nick explained it to me in the most understandable manner, you know, with his background there. He said the belief is that if you get, you know, if you reach this holy grail before everybody else, no one else will be able to catch up with you. And, my thought is, well, doesn't innovation continue? And he's like, no, if you reach this holy grail that they have, and I'm butchering this for Nick, but this is what I heard, is they'll always stay two steps ahead of you. So that seems to be the belief that these companies have. If we get there, then nobody will ever be able to catch us because our artificial intelligence will be able to outsmart everyone from this point forward without ever looking back.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they call that the digital canyon. Once you create a digital canyon, nobody can cross it. That's the idea, but it's a really kind of an all-in bet. And Paul, I'm old enough to remember when AI deals created value in the marketplace. And and that was so last September, though. Financial Times just put this out today, said, "Good morning, New York. While you were sleeping, this was the most read story on Financial Times, and it's about Oracle's $300 billion OpenAI deal." Remember that? Yeah. It's now valued at minus $74 billion, one of the fastest third of a trillion dollar value wipeouts in history. So what happened? Do you remember this? So this is Oracle's stock right here. Again, nothing is either for or against any particular share, neither recommendation. You know, it was coming along, trundling along. You remember this moment right here? This huge pop? Yeah, that was this. That on September 10th, it was announced OpenAI and Oracle to sign this $300 billion computing deal. Biggest in history. It was amazing. Oracle, I think you and I talked about it. They said, oh, we're going to have revenues that basically 4X, 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 and 5X or something like forever, you know? And that was that. And since then, reality has begun to set in.
Very quickly.
And not only that, quickly. So Oracle, the only way they could get this done, though, because OpenAI doesn't have any of that money. So they don't have any. They're a cash-burning machine right now. They don't have money. So where do they get the money? Well, Oracle said, well, we'll go into debt. So they levered up a bunch of debt. And I mean, a lot of debt. This is Oracle's debt to equity ratio compared to all the other direct AI stocks out there, right? I mean, look at AMD way over here, you know. But there's Oracle at 520%. So they got a lot of debt. So that's okay. It's going to pay off, right? But this, for anybody who doesn't remember what happened in 2008 and 9, this is called a credit default swap. This is if you had Oracle's debt, they sold some debt, you own it, but you'd like to ensure that if it goes bad, if they can't pay it or it takes a big haircut, you can get insurance. And there's somebody on the other side of that who will sell you that insurance product, right? In 2008, we found out that was AIG selling naked credit default swaps, just selling them as if they would never have to pay. And then when they had to pay, there was no there, and they had, you know, what'd they take, $175 billion for a bailout? I forget, something big like that. Anyway, this is just showing that, you know, in the last couple of months since that September deal, Oracle's debt has gone from 45 basis points of, you know, coverage to 104. So it's more than doubled.
Yeah, 220%, something like that, just off the top of my head. Like, dramatic increase.
Yeah. So if you want to insure against Oracle debt not going bust, it's expensive. And so these are important but wonky market signals. But this just says, wow, Paul, don't you remember it was just September, where a deal like popped its stock like this huge amount. Everybody was so giddy. What's mm-hmm. happened?
Yeah.
I think reality is setting in.
Reality is starting to set in. And, you know, and if that breaks that narrative, you know, and if it's happening this quickly and close to that deal, then this could get really ugly really quickly. And I think that reminds me of a headline that came out. Reuters, in a speech, let's see here, when the speech was out, a headline comes out, "No firm is immune if the AI bubble bursts," the Google CEO tells BBC. So they're starting to recognize that this is going to be something that's going to just absolutely ripple through and earthquake through the AI theme if this doesn't pan out the way they anticipate it to be. And we're starting to see enough warning signs around there that they've just way overestimated how quickly this was going to unfold.
This is hearkening to that nice chart over your head there, history of bubbles. So this is another way to look at it. So There were some bubbles back here in U.S. housing in 68 to 70, and there was a looking at these percentage increases going on here and comparing the dot-com to Japan's great thing. I don't know why they got gold in here. I'm not sure which period they're referring to. Has gold ever really been in a bubble? I don't think it has yet, but we'll see. Anyway, whoever put this together, but anyway, the NASDAQ is clearly head and shoulders above everybody else here at this point in time, just racing really far ahead. And so, as you and I have talked about with bubbles, Paul, bubbles exist when asset prices rise beyond what incomes can sustain. And, you know, there's like some hoopla that there's always a story, right? And lots of credit. So that's what's been enabled here. If this breaks, how bad do you think it could get?
That's a really good question. And I think it could get really ugly. Really ugly. Like, if this thing breaks and we don't have some other narrative, the question is what can the Fed do and what can the government do to stop it? What are they going to do? Send $10,000 checks to every citizen?
Maybe.
Okay, now we're in a currency crisis and inflation is 10 times worse than what it has been before because we've reached the point of diminishing returns. Or do they try that and the inflation exacerbates the little bit of money that the average individual has? But I wouldn't be surprised to see the NASDAQ down and even the S&P 50%, if not more, if this thing bursts, in spite of their ability initially to start printing a lot of money. So I think it could be really bad. It could be life-changing for a lot of baby boomers that are overweight equities at this point. And here's another concerning thing that I'm hearing out there right now, Chris, and this worries me a lot because I have a lot of conversations with clients when we do the retirement plan analysis about how much can I spend. And there's that fine balance, you know, the minimum level of success in retirement, depending upon what your goals are, is the only check that bounces is to the funeral home. Okay, like that's the perfect retirement, but you can, you know, you don't know how much longer you're going to live or where you're going to get there. So I'm hearing like Wall Street's like, you're not spending enough money. You're not spending enough money. That may be true for a lot of people, okay, or some people. But for the average individual, that's a very dangerous thing, especially in this environment when you're being marketed to, because, you know, the equity growth that we've had is highly unusual throughout history, especially since 2010. And if it's built on a theme and this is just the everything bubble that we're in, those individuals are overweight equities. Okay. They're anticipating that that's going to continue from this point forward. And then if this thing cracks and the government prints enough money to where inflation is sustained, there's going to be a lot of forced liquidations of portfolios and people's retirements. The vision that they have retirement is going to turn into a nightmare or a horror show because they're not going to have time to recover from it.
Okay. Well, let's burrow into that because this is really important. I think, you know, you and I have covered, well, let me see if I got, I put it here. Okay, first, this is kind of interesting. So this is the rate of change of margin debt. So margin debt, for anybody listening, is when maybe you or maybe a firm, an investing firm or a private equity or a hedge fund, if they want to put more money in the stock market than they actually have, you can borrow against your existing portfolio of shares. Typically 50% would be kind of the limit. And then you can put that money also into shares. So margin debt is a very, it's a levered bet that prices are going to go up usually, typically. I suppose you could have margin debt and be shorting too, but it's a different process. At any rate, the point is that the rate of change here of this margin debt over the past 6 months, you have to go all the way back to 2000 to find it's equal. It's better. So the people have, like, investors have just been slapping it on. Like, really complacent. Like, now's the time not only to go long, but go long on leverage, which, again, easy come, easy go. Leverage bets do drive markets higher, but when they unwind, they tend to tumble them down the other direction, right? They amplify moves both ways.
They do, because you've got margin calls, you get individuals that are forced sellers. And if you go back to that chart, I want to point out a couple of other spikes that we saw in there, if you can pull it up easily. So if you look back there in 1999, we had this massive spike in rate of change. Okay, so what happened in hindsight? You had an 80%, I think it was 80% decline in the NASDAQ, but 47% in the S&P. So then reality sets in for a short period of time, in spite of the fact that, the Fed policy back then was to fuel a housing bubble. So then going into 2007, you get another big spike, okay, mm-hmm. just in time for the 2008 crisis. Yep. Well, so then you have a recovery. But go back and look at what occurred back in 2019 into 2021. So right into 2021, you had another big spike. Well, remember what happened in 2022?
Bad year.
S&P down 20%. You had the bond market down 20%, which was the worst combination in, 40 years prior to that. So we have all of these warnings that we can look back and see that people get caught up in this euphoria and this narrative that they build themselves, and they don't pay attention to the fundamentals that are below them, right? They're making decisions based off of a period of time that was built on a granite or rock foundation, and they have no clue that the foundation beneath all of this excess leverage that they have is complete sand. If not sand, it's hay, and one spark's going to cause the whole thing to come apart, and then they're forced out. So, we want to be aggressive at the bottom, 2001 there, 2009. Even in 2022, hindsight's clear that you want to be a little more aggressive there. Mm-hmm. And you want to harvest those profits when everybody else is going all in. So you take a look at Buffett. You know, I get it that he's retiring right now, but they've been net sellers, I believe, at least on the data that we have, past 24 months, if I remember correctly, largest cash pile that they've had throughout history. The reason why he's been so successful over time is because at those extremes, he's going to start peeling chips off the table, getting prudent and resilient so that he's has some flexibility to buy. And then when everybody else is selling from an emotional standpoint, because they have to, or because their emotions take over, that's when he goes and buys, and that's when it creates the most value. So that's just another sign right now that we're in a very tedious, dangerous period of time, and you're going to have a low probability outcome for this to continue going forward. This is a time to be prudent. It's just another marker and a bit of evidence to tell us that you should be cautious. You should be cautious right now. I'm not saying you sell everything today, but you better have an exit plan and at least have a decision point where if this line is crossed, without hesitation, I'm going to make a prudent decision, and we'll see what that outcome is in the future.
Well, to carry on with that, I mean, I circled them here in red, but you know, we had this big explosion here of margin debt in 1999, and then of course we had the wipeout beginning in 2000. So that was a 20% drawdown in the S&P there, which is this light color, and then later through coming into 2003, there was another almost 30% drawdown, high 20s right there. Then we had the 2007 where there was this 30% increase in margin debt, but oops, that was followed by 2009 with a 35% drawdown in the S&P, or 40. That's a 40% drawdown. Again, we got up to this level, and there was a 15% drawdown. We get up to 2021. Now we're down to another 20% drawdown, because that's where that brings us, right there, the 20 zone. So yeah, it just says, yep, okay. People get ebullient. That happens. But this time, you know what's different this time? And I hate using those words, but this is different. We haven't had this concentration in the markets before.
No.
Where everything's kind of being held up by just 10 companies, right? Mm-hmm. Really seven, you know? But so wonder what happens when you know, leverage unwinds and you have that thin, you only have generals. There's no foot soldiers in this story, you know?
That's right. Well, you get a reversion to the mean and beyond the mean. And people believe that we don't have reversion to the mean anymore. I mean, that's just kind of the what people have convinced themselves, because it's been so long that the Fed's been able to step in and bail out and not have the inflationary impulses that have taken place. Well, that makes sense when you have all of the damage that was done after 2008. But once that damage was kind of done and leverage builds back into the system with all of this liquidity, we're just getting a hint of the inflation that will continue to come if the Fed steps in and just prints like crazy. And my biggest concern right now, Chris, and I know I disagree with a lot, but, you know, I may disagree. I think one thing that we both agree on is the only thing they know to do is print, right? My concern is right now with what I'm seeing under the surface and watching the indicators like what the dollar is doing. Now, I can change my mind if the weight of the information changes, but I am extremely concerned about deflation over the next 6 to 12 months. Do we get it? I don't know. Maybe it's 24 months from now. When you're in this euphoria, it's impossible to determine the top because you're so detached from fundamentals. But I mean, we've got a potential head and shoulders developing on the NASDAQ right now. You've got Bitcoin that has just been absolutely cratered. Gold's holding up surprisingly well under the circumstances. I mean, you take a look at let's see here. Here's another chart that I can have. Now, look, can you make decisions on this right now? No. So this is Henrik Zeeberg. Job openings versus the S&P 500, the real economy and the disconnecting financial markets. No, there's not a bubble. But if you look at that, job openings have pretty much followed where the S&P 500 has. But this is another marker that we're in la-la land at this point. It starts to follow. S&P 500 takes off, but job openings have been dropping. Now, you could say that they're solidifying in this area, but the weight of the information tells us there is a huge disconnect right here. And if we don't get the perfect scenario, or if the Fed's not willing to print like they did before, or they print and it doesn't matter. A lot of people forget going into 2008 at the worst part of it. You know, the Fed's coming out saying everything's okay. Bernanke's saying, you know, subprime is contained. And then they printed, and then they had to print a lot to kind of stop it at the bottom, but you had that deleveraging take place. So my concern is that all of this euphoria has led to complacency and leverage and over-leveraging. I'm running into more people than ever right now that's like, yeah, I decided not to sell my Bitcoin because it's going to go up forever, right? The government's going to, the debasement trade. And so I leveraged against that. And then I went and bought a condo over here and I'm going to turn it into a rental. So, oh yeah, we're getting a cash buyer over here, but you're leveraged in something that has perceived value. But unlike gold, for example, I'm just laying out the differences. Gold has a utility use in the manufacturing process and a monetary value. It's going to have some value, even if it's just for jewelry. You can't turn your Bitcoin into jewelry, right? I mean, there's advantages to it. I wish that it had not been, in my opinion, captured. But I'm extremely concerned that deflation is the greatest risk that we have right now in the interim period, strictly because of the complacency around debt and leverage. And that all shows easy money, complacency, and over-leveraging yourself can wipe you out quicker than anything else. And so many people that don't need to carry this risk are carrying this risk right now. I mean, it's one thing if you're trying to do anything that you can do to survive with a great business idea. It's another thing if you've reached escape velocity, you've accumulated enough assets that you can comfortably retire and stop working and have that freedom. And then the temptation of greed, which greed is more powerful than fear, otherwise people wouldn't leverage themselves like they are. And you put yourself in a position to where you can be absolutely wiped out and not have time to recover. And another concern that I have is that even if the Fed does print a lot, it's not going to have this instant bailout like it did before. When the NASDAQ bubble burst, you had the housing bubble that they could fuel. Right now, we're in the midst of a housing bubble that's frozen, and I'm saying a bubble from the standpoint of the average person can't afford a home, okay, especially the younger generation. So housing is overpriced. You know, the valuations on the market are ridiculously overpriced. So where is the rescue going to come from at this point? I don't know. I mean, maybe it'll be there, and we'll see it as this starts to unfold. But I'm more concerned about deflation in the short run than I have been at any time since 2007 with the data I'm seeing right now.
Well, that fits with what Ed Dowd was telling me. He's expecting that same thing. And of course, the Fed needs some cover to start printing, and that cover has to be a scare of some kind. So nothing like a good deflationary market wipeout to make them afraid and justify, you know, the next round of printing. But we all know in our heart of hearts they're going to print, right? So that makes sense. Paul, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, there's something very surprising about Bitcoin. I want to go over with you, and we'll take a look at that as soon as we come back. Hey, folks, Chris Martinson here. Look, we've all been there watching our hard-earned dollars get chewed up by this endless inflation machine, while the folks in Washington and the big banks continue to play games with our money like it's Monopoly cash or something. It's not right. I know it, and you know it. The trust in the system? It's eroding faster than a sandcastle at high tide, especially with all the geopolitical storms brewing. Now, I've been saying it for years. You got to protect yourself, your family, from all this nonsense. That's why I personally turn to gold and silver, the real deal, physical stuff that you can hold in your hands under your control, not some digital promise that could vanish overnight. Everyone should own some. It's just common sense in times like these. But here's the thing. When I need it stored securely, away from prying eyes, I use Goldcorp. They're the ones I trust. They ship it right to your door, really quick if you want to hold it in your hands, but also if you prefer, they can stash it in top-tier vaults in places like Switzerland or Singapore or right here in the United States. Your call, your metal. And for you, my friends who follow Peak Prosperity, they'll hook you up with the first 6 months of storage absolutely free. That's how much they value real people like us. Buying and selling? Hey, it's as easy as trading stocks, but way better. Because with Goldcorp, you're the sole owner. Fully allocated, fully segregated, in your name only. No sharing with strangers, no funny business, no security entitlement nonsense. Need cash fast? Sell in seconds at market price? Want it in your hands? Hey, one click and it's shipped. They've got everything from coins and bars to allowing for self-directed IRAs, all locked down and secure. It's simple, it's safe, and straightforward. Take charge of your future, folks. Don't wait for the system to fail you any further. Head over to peak.fan/goldcore. That's peak.fan/goldcore right now and claim that free storage. You won't regret it. I sure don't. All right, welcome back, everybody. Bitcoin, I was a little surprised when Charlie Bilello, you know, we both like him a lot, puts out good charts. He says, so the Bitcoin story was, it started out as a peer-to-peer lending thing, and then some people got their hands on it, and now it's supposed to be digital gold. So he's tracking, and by the way, it really became marketed as digital gold when they launched the ETFs for it, right? So mm-hmm. Wall Street suddenly likes it a lot because they can start managing it and charging management fees for operating the ETFs. Get it? Okay. No disagreement with that. I understand. However, the total return since inception of the first Bitcoin ETFs of January 2024 compared to gold, gold is outperforming digital gold since the beginning of the ETFs. And I don't even think that includes today's price action, which you can see right below me down there. Who knows if it sticks? It's a very volatile asset, but could go up, could go down. We don't know. But I found that kind of surprising. I saw your eyebrows shoot up too, so.
Yeah, I do find that surprising, actually, because I had just assumed, without tracking both of those, that Bitcoin was still outpacing gold just because of the sheer euphoria and the marketing that's coming from the major wirehouses to push these ETFs out there. Mm-hmm. Because they're not marketing gold, quite frankly.
No.
They're just not. I don't have anybody... Yeah, I don't have anybody that's running modern portfolio theory that's claiming that, you know, the single best idea to build a business is gold right now. They're selling what's popular. So that actually surprises me dramatically.
Yeah, and here in the U.S., of course, I mean, China has a different story. That their people are very excited and saving and investing in gold there. U.S., no, I mean, I go and cover this all the time. When they do write about gold, it's almost always when it falls, and they use very negative terms and descriptors and adjectives and all. Yeah, it's a very obvious ploy to say, hey, Western person, you don't want to be in gold. You want to be in exciting, shiny Bitcoin. And, you know, they always use different. You just look at it and you can start to detect there's a clear element of. It's not even too strong. It's propaganda. Propaganda to me is emotionally emotionally leading verbiage that's designed to move you in a thought direction, right? That's that's what it does. So they've been marketing Bitcoin really favorably and anti-marketing gold for a long time. So that's why this was a little surprising. And you see gold down there, nothing fancy. It's just trundling along, you know, and right. It's just, you know, just climbing and climbing, much less drama. This is very dramatic. With Bitcoin does make big giant moves and all this and that.
It does.
But on the other side of that, you know, one of the, again, neither for or against any particular security, but right now, as of this recording, we're watching the stock for MicroStrategy, MSTR is its ticker, is a levered bet on Bitcoin, which is an interesting concept. Honestly, I think if you want to be in Bitcoin, that's fine, be in Bitcoin. But to be levered in a vehicle, which is a little bit opaque, I study it, but maybe not as much as I should. I can never figure out what he was up to. They have preferred shares with warrants that trigger under certain conditions that have a very high, you know, he's basically 10.25%, had to bump that to 10.5% to attract money so that he could put that into Bitcoin. So that's when you're taking high interest debt to put it into a volatile asset, there's a chance that could work out really well, and there's a chance that could work out really not well, right? Such is the nature of the game.
Yeah, it's like Russian roulette with a big payoff. And my question is how are you going to pay that? Bitcoin doesn't generate dividends, right? Like, you're not getting paid while you're sitting there hold it. So are you taking new money that's coming in to service that debt? Are you selling off as you go up to service that debt? I don't know. I saw a headline that brought that up, and I was hoping to read it before we read the article before we started today, but my meeting lasted a little longer, so I didn't get to it.
This is what we're looking at for today. And you can see it. I don't think it's done falling. This brings me back, Paul. This is reminding me. I was back in the day when I was playing the housing bubble, not as effectively as Michael Burry, clearly, but you know, I was shorting housing stocks and mortgage insurers. Those were my two favorite targets. This is what it looked like when they finally started to let go. They just erode. The bounces are totally meaningless, you know. And it just has a lot of selling pressure.
And here's the problem. This is the psychology of what happens to investors on the other side. Okay. So what happens is, you're euphoric in that bubble. And I've got to keep that on this computer where you can go through the cycle of market emotions. You're euphoric. Right. I'm a long-term investor. I'm a hodler, right? Isn't that what they call it? Hodlers?
Yep. So hold on for dear life. HODL, a hodler.
Hold on for dear life. A hodler. Well, all of a sudden it cracks, okay? Now, and then we convince ourselves, well, you're scared to get out here, right? You were scared to get out at the top because you thought you were going to make money. Mm-hmm. Now you're scared to get out here because of the fact that, hey, this is just volatility in this space. It's going to continue to bounce, okay? Or it's going to bounce. I'll sell when we get a little bit higher. Well, when you get that bounce, all of a sudden the narrative comes back and you believe that it's going to go back to all-time highs, so you freeze, and then it keeps going lower and lower. So one thing I have a conversation with clients about when they're overweight one category or they've reached escape velocity, they have enough margin for error to retire, is I ask the question, what good is a strategy if failure is too costly to bear? And what I mean by that is, if I had to choose, not a recommendation, guys, where this is educational, this is just not a recommendation, but if I had to choose, okay, and I wanted to be overweight in that space, well, I would rather own Bitcoin directly than to have the leverage from MSTR. Because let's say we have a deflationary event, you know, inflation stays persistent, deflation in asset prices, but continued inflation in cost of living, and people are forced sellers to make their ends meet until we get through that congestion period of time. Well, let's say it goes down 90%. Okay, it goes down 90%. If you're holding just basic crypto without leverage, then you can wait it out if you're in a position where you're not forced to sell it. But if you own something like MSTR that's got leverage on the inside of it, there is a point to where the asset is worth less than the loans. And I don't know if he's going to have to face margin calls or whatever, but that is a very tedious situation. So worst case scenario, if it goes down and goes sideways for 5 or 6 years before it takes off and goes up 500 or 600%, then that's the end or bankruptcy of that MSTR. I'm not saying that'll happen. I'm just hypothetically comparing one to another versus where Bitcoin, you just kind of sit on it. So the question is, do you really want to carry the risk at this level with the downside risk and the leverage that's in MSTR? I mean, it's very sexy and fun on the ride up, and people can justify themselves, but it's a lottery ticket mentality more so than true investing.
Well, yeah. And of course, there's the possibility of a death spiral for MSTR because their core asset they have is Bitcoin. So if they trigger anything in there where they have to suddenly raise capital, well, you can either try and issue more debt, good luck with that, or equity, good luck with that when you're under pressure. So the only thing they have left is to sell Bitcoin. But as they sell Bitcoin, it probably goes lower. And the lower it goes, the more they have to sell. And that's the death spiral, right? Because they're not an insignificant holder. It's last count I saw, they held $74 billion worth, which is now obviously a lot less because that was a few days ago and Bitcoin's fallen since then. But, you know, you have to find a buyer for billions and billions and billions of dollars of stuff, you know, that's falling. It's not a good time. There are knife catchers out there, but it's a thinner market.
It is a thinner market. And at some point, people are just going to freeze, right? When the price stops, even if you want to add more, you're just going to stand back until at least it finds some type of bottom or sustained uptrend again, especially institutions and professions. They're just going to stand back until it finds a bottom because they've learned early in their career that catching a falling knife is something that can leave scars that'll be with you for the rest of your life. So you wait. Hey, so what? I miss a little opportunity in the short run. I'll wait till that trend establishes again. So then your buyers evaporate and you've got four sellers, and that's where these things end in a hurry, those bubbles. Yep.
Well, so of the many things we have on our plate right now, obviously margin debt very high. That's a factor. We've had euphoria. We have this hyper concentration, right? We have now, oops, this story that maybe AI is, you know, got some realities that are going to impinge. On top of all this, Paul, I have to add this, which is Lisa Abramovitz just posted this out this morning, saying that investors are holding one of the lowest proportions of cash in modern history. November B of A Global Fund Manager Survey, cash levels of 3.7% or lower has occurred 20 times since 2002. And on every occasion, stocks fell and treasuries outperformed in the following 1 to 3 months. So that's kind of that's all in. Investors are all in. We don't have any cash. It's all in. I've borrowed money. I've put it all in the market. We're all in. And so what normally happens when things turn a little bit is people say, well, maybe I have to raise some cash. You know?
Right. Right. You know,
for reasons. And not only are these investors all in, but I know you know this because you're running an active risk managed strategy, but it turns out we've hit the crossover now where they're also just letting it ride. Passive is now a larger proportion of portfolios than active management.
Mm-hmm.
So passive.
That doesn't surprise me at all.
What's passive? Just so everybody's following along.
Yeah, passive is no attempt to do any, and you're price insensitive. If you have money available, then you're going to put it to work in a passive S&P 500 index. The argument is because you can't predict the future. The argument also is you'll never outperform the index. Active can never outperform the index. That's their argument. But, you know, you put it in there and it doesn't matter if there's three nukes in the air and a pandemic that's killing 60% of the population at the same time, then you will not sell unless you need the money. That's the argument for passive. And my argument is, you ever going to get a promotion at work if you're just passive? You just sit there and stare at your screen all day? You know, are you ever going to get in shape if you're just passive? Like, yeah, I mean, I could come up with all kinds of terrible analogies about how passive doesn't make sense. Now, I will say this. I understand, because of the marketing power and because of the way the indexes are designed, that you know, they have marketed to you as an individual that you have to beat the index. You have to beat the index. They've got everybody whipped up into some frenzy that you know, you're a bad person, you're a fool, you're not intellectually smart if you're not beating the index. The reality is, if everybody is passive, everybody owns the exact same thing, and then you've just got a society where if you start on third base, then you're going to always stay ahead. And I just disagree with that. I believe that prudence and wisdom and discipline will produce better fruit with less stress and more sustainability over the long term. But the marketing power behind them is crazy. Because yeah. I'll tell you, I mean, I have a friend of mine that's on a 401k, you know, selection board, and we were having a conversation. And he's like, Paul, we have a fiduciary responsibility to pick the best performing asset class. You do have a fiduciary responsibility, but all of this marketing is in the right places to where it's there. And Michael Green does a good job of talking about how it's distorted the market on the upside. So all of these funds coming in, I think he was talking about a new study the other day, said that they thought, the intellectuals thought, that passive investing, $1 goes in, it maybe impacts 1.1, just a minor inflation of assets. But he's saying now it's 6 to 8 times or 5 to 8 times, because I want to underestimate what I think it was. High tide was 8 times. So if those passive fund flows coming in, that market becomes reliant upon unemployment staying low and the baby boomer generation not having to tap those funds and turn into forced liquidators. So what's caused it to be distorted on the upside, and he makes a phenomenal argument for it, that whenever those net contributions turn into net distributions, that it's going to magnify the downside on the other side. So we're just in an unsustainable path.
Well, speaking of that, then let's, we've talked about this a little bit. There are some more fundamentals here, which is we're starting to see this is a pretty hefty spike in U.S. notices of layoffs for these are mass layoffs. So they track mass layoffs. I think it has to be, I forget what it is. It's more than 100 at a time. A company has to inform the official record keepers about it. But we saw that mass spiking happen here in 2008, right? In 2009, obviously COVID, that's like way off the chart. But here, this is kind of rare territory, so we have layoffs there, and it's hard to sort of get a read from this, because this is also a little bit above trend here. So somebody else put this chart together to show, okay, so what are these layoffs that we see here year to date, and the big fat line here is 2025, but only 2020 and 2009 are actually higher than 2025 on this chart, right? So I wasn't aware of it. It's pretty bad. So, but I've been hearing anecdotes, Paul. People have been saying it's harder to find a job than you think, right? And this is something that's really important. And anybody listening to this, I really want to impress upon you, if you do get laid off, just emergency cut your expenditures. It's hard. People have sustained things. You know, I've got a nanny. My kids are in these private schools. We had this vacation coming up that's been on the books forever. We still are going to maintain the leases on these 3 new cars. Whatever the story is, sometimes people find it, they just have the idea, well, I'll get another job and we'll keep moving. But if that doesn't happen, things can get dicey pretty quick out there. So
it really can. And that's one of the reasons I've been kind of saying on the podcast here is, you know, please build your emergency funds, sweep some off the top, put yourself in a resilient position. You know, I lean towards having 24 months worth of emergency funds on hand right now, because we're at a very unusual cycle that we've seen throughout history. And look, worst case scenario, you know, another thing that bothers me, the debasement trade gets all over the news media here recently, right? It's debasement trade. You look at research, you know, and I get it from a long-term standpoint, we've got major issues. We could end up in a currency crisis, but don't let the fear of losing some purchasing power on your emergency savings funds in the interim period cause you to put yourself in a position to where you lose your house. You're a forced seller of some of these investments that you know, may be good long term, but you can't get rid of, or you're forced to sell because you're either going to lose your house, you're going to lose your car, or you're not going to be able to eat in the interim period. So I can't stress this enough. For those of you that are out there, make sure you've got at least 12 months worth of your expenses. And if you lose your job, like you said, cut it to the bare bone immediately. I cannot tell you how many people in 2008 got absolutely wiped out because they did not believe that it was going to be as bad as it was, and they continued spending until it was too late. I can't tell you how many people refused to have emergency funds in place. I mean, one classic example, there was a young individual that came in, had $10,000 put to work, and I said, look, I'm not going to do it unless you got at least 12 months worth of emergency fund. And they wanted to buy Home Depot. Okay. So they bought it and, you know, here it's down to what, $15, $16, $17. And I get a phone call. It's like, I got to sell that Home Depot. I'm like, well, have you been through your emergency fund already? It's like, no, I lied to you and told you that I had an emergency fund. And I'm like, this is the worst place to sell, right? This is where you want to buy. And they're like, I don't have a choice. I lost my job, and it's either I lose my house or I don't eat, and I don't have anybody that can come bail me out. And they were forced to sell Home Depot at that point to maintain their home. The good thing is they got a job, They kept their home. The bad thing is, you know, Home Depot went straight up for the next 10 years on the other side of that. And there was no guarantee that that could happen, but they put themselves in a position to where they made a good long-term investment because of their lack of just foundation from financial planning, they were forced out of something. So I'm at the point right now, build it up to 24 months. You know, each individual's circumstance is different. 6 months in a treasury money market, you know, 12-month CD on that, and then maybe a one-year treasury or a CD on the other side of that so that you've got some space to get there to break those out. And so what if you have to sell a CD and you lose a couple of months' interest? You've got that guaranteed that's in that area to give yourself some resiliency so that if you want to be a long-term holder of something, you're not forced out of it at the last time. Because I can say beyond the shadow of a doubt in the past 27 years, if you're not in a position to survive the storm, you will be a forced seller of something if you haven't sold on the front end with a risk managed strategy.
Yep.
So please
yep.
get an emergency fund.
I totally concur with that. And the other thing I suggest strongly for people is when you're in a bubble moment like this, just have an idea of stuff that you would want to buy, right? Keep some powder dry, and then know what your price target for that would be. So I've been just eyeballing a lot of energy companies. It's still not quite right, you know, but mm-hmm. your time will come, right? Or, you know, I like commodities, so I'm staring at a variety of different commodity areas. And, you know, but the prices aren't quite where I want them to be. I think they'll get there, mm-hmm. right? So, but having that idea, because it's super hard, as you said, to sell near a top, right? Because it's just going to keep going. And it's super hard to buy at a bottom because it's just going to keep going that way too. But, you know, mm-hmm. the pendulum doth swing back and forth. And that's the best trades I've ever made are things, Paul, that I bought and I just sat on because mm-hmm. I had an idea, you know, silver and gold mm-hmm. being two of those things for me.
Yeah. And it took time and you wondered whether, you know, I know you did the research, but if you're like me and everybody else who's been in that space for quite some time, there were times it's like, I'm doing it on math, but you have a period of hope, but that hope comes from the research that you did. The hope comes from the fundamentals that are in there. The hope isn't, well, it's different this time, right? Like fundamentals don't matter anymore. It's the new age, but you're doing it based on, and it takes time. I mean, the best investments are going to test your patience, and the ones that you buy typically from a long-term standpoint that do the best are the ones that kind of make you sick to your stomach because you're not sure whether your research is right, but you've done enough to know, hey, at some point in the future, the market will come to where I am. When you're following the herd around in an environment like this and buying what's popular and whatever, what's easy to buy, it's easy to buy what's popular. It's easy to buy, you know, something that your brother-in-law, for example, has been bragging about for some time, and you know you're smarter than your brother-in-law. In all fairness, there are a couple of people that know my brother-in-laws, both of them. I love my brother-in-laws. This is just an analogy for people to hear. But you know, do it for the right reasons. Emotional decisions don't pan out well from a long-term standpoint. We have to pay attention to discipline. Fundamentals matter. Cash flow matters from a long-term standpoint.
Cash flow. This is one of my big things. And I know dividend stocks have been out of favor for a while. I think they'll come back into favor because ultimately, when you own a share in a company, you're a part owner, and that entitles you to some flow of the profits of that company. Those are called dividends. Paul, something I hate more than anything is reading these headlines that say, "Company X decides to return money to shareholders by buying back shares." Nope, I'm a shareholder. Nothing happened. No cash came my way. It's like we got to be Jerry Maguire, you know, show me the money. It's all got to be the cash, right? It should be very simple. Companies should return cash to shareholders. Mm-hmm. There's already a mechanism for it. We don't have to invent a new one called buying back the shares, which when you peel it back 9 times out of 10, that's because they diluted the shares by issuing a bunch of shares to the C-suite. So they bought them back. So they didn't return money to shareholders. They returned money to the C-suite. That's a totally different process, you know, but I want to see dividends come back in vogue. Companies should pay dividends. That's how you return money to shareholders.
Yes, you do. And like, we have one of the simple requirements for our dividend stock strategy. And I will say that's not my favorite strategy right now, because most of these dividend stocks are not paying dividends that are good enough and they're still too expensive. Mm-hmm. But one of the requirements is you can't pay out more than 75% of your profits and earnings in dividends, because I want them to reinvest back into the company so that they can continue to grow those dividends over time. Never do you, if a company we have in our dividend strategy borrows money to pay a dividend, out. We're going to go find somebody else, right? There's too many good dividend paying companies out there. Now, that's a tough space right now. Mm-hmm. Value's a tough space. And I still think that most dividend stocks are overpriced at this moment in time. But cash flow matters. And I like going back to the Chipotle analogy we had. It's 35 times earnings, right? And the stock's really been taken out to the woodshed here recently. But at the same time, why, you know, go to a bank and try to buy a local restaurant and borrow the money at 35 times their earnings and see if they're going to loan it to you. They're just not going to do it, because they know that it's not a sustainable business model from a long-term standpoint. But when you've got money sloshing around the economy and these narratives that are taking place, investors get caught up in the euphoria and they forget the fundamentals. The bad thing is there's not many advisors in the industry anymore who actually understand fundamentals. They just don't. You know, they're buying a story and they're selling the story instead of understanding what they own. I tell people, always know what you own and why you own it, or at least have an advisor that knows what you own and why you own it. That's the most important rule right there. And what's worst case scenario? Always look at worst case scenario, because if you're not prepared for worst case scenario, you might get caught up in it, which you think is worst case scenario, and you emotionally sell at a point where you should be buying. And good stocks are going to test your patience to where it's a buying opportunity. And other stocks, when they crack, that's the end of the trend and the downside is so high, you need to be able to get away from it and redeploy that capital somewhere else. And there's unbelievable opportunities out there. I mean, like, I like commodities. I like emerging markets. I like value stocks right now. And I'm not saying that they don't go down further. I'm just saying that I've got an incredible list, if we get this deflation and market crack, of investments that have been overlooked. They're unpopular right now, but they may be the workhorses for the portfolios for people going forward to help, you know, help them build their wealth, or at least fight off inflation, or make it through retirement without using up all their funds.
Yeah. Yeah. And part of the reason I did my last thing here, part of the reason that I think everything has been so frothy and like, why can't things go down is because Tavi Costa here writes, crazy to think about money supply. This is global money supply is expanding this aggressively, even as global central bank balance sheets have been contracting. We've seen $10 trillion increase in global money supply in just the past 12 months.
That's incredible.
Now, imagine what happens once central banks inevitably need to expand their balance sheets again, which in my view is only a matter of time, he writes here. If this helps, you know, mute the recent volatility noise in hard assets, this is the macro data point that ultimately drives that cycle. So China's been printing like crazy. The banks have been anyway, money supply. Woohoo! How have things gotten this frothy and complacent? Because this is an uninterrupted, look at this, Paul. This is just absolute explosive growth in money supply right here.
That's incredible. That's incredible.
And the red is the central bank balance sheets, which indeed has been coming down. Normally, they're very coincident, but money creation is now happening outside of the central bank ecosystem. Which is probably why, I don't know if you caught this, Paul, but last Friday, the Federal Reserve held a meeting with banks to discuss liquidity issues in the marketplace. And I was like, that has a little 2007 smell to me. You know, remember there were some popping sounds that went off, Bear Stearns 2007. I think you said, in hindsight, that was the moment. That should have been the moment where we kind of said, uh-oh, right? And of course, it was papered over and everything was fine and it wasn't, right? That was the story. So I'm starting to get that sense again that there's some plumbing issues happening here. And
there seems to be, you know, and back in 2007, so Bear Stearns cracked in February, I believe, of 2008. And then oil skyrocketed into the summer.
July.
July. And then it cracked. But to an extent, you know, that was hindsight. Everybody's concerned about the debasement trade. Fed's going to bail us out. Well, everybody thought they were, and then they didn't, and it reversed hard. And then going back to that central bank chart, what are the central banks of the world doing? They're continuing to buy gold and stack it inside their books. And who knows, maybe they're doing Bitcoin, but we're seeing it in the gold flows and what's out there. And that tells me two things, right? If all this money printing doesn't work and we get into a credit crisis, gold has no counterparty risk, especially if you're holding it in your hand or a segregated custodian. There's no debt on the other side to default on. So it protects you against a currency crisis, and it also protects you against that counterparty risk on the other side. And I do think a lot of gold's move has had to do with individuals that are more concerned about counterparty risk in an environment where you're starting to see all of these frauds and complacency come to the surface.
Yeah, no, gold is sometimes called the anti-dollar. This time, I think it's just displaying the level of trust that has evaporated from the system, right? So, listen, it's just something, you know what? You shouldn't have to work that hard to understand money, right? It should be the more basic, the better, because you should be able to trust that that thing you have in your hand is what it is, and it has the immutable characteristics of money, right? You know, medium of exchange, store of value, fungible, those kinds of things. And you know, there are a lot of money systems we have out there right now, which make my head hurt. And people tell me I haven't studied them enough, or you have to like put in hours and hours to study them. And to me, that means it's not actually money. If you have to study something that hard, probably isn't money. You know, money should be really simple.
It should be simple. It should be easy to understand, to explain, and transact in. And there should be a trust associated with it as well.
Yeah.
And it has to be stable to an extent. You can't have it swinging all over the place.
Indeed. Indeed. So, Paul, I think we've come to the end of our time here. Any last words for our listeners today?
Well, if you don't mind taking just a few more minutes, there is one thing that I want to share.
Sure.
And I just want to point this out. Look, we don't know, okay? We just don't know. And I know there's a lot going on in this chart, but that black line is the S&P 500 index going back to, I think it's 1926 that we have the data. That red dotted line is a price-earnings ratio of 20, which is considered an overvalued market. The blue is a fair-valued market, and the green is an undervalued market. Okay, so one thing I want to notice is coming out of the Great Depression, we got really excited. Market got a little overvalued in there. Now, that was overvalued for that generation, quite frankly, but it's on the upper end of that range. Now, in 1974, you had a cracking of the market, but notice what happens here. Corporate earnings went up because of the inflation, but corporate profits, and this was right about the time the Nifty 50 cracked. I can't remember exactly when, but the market would surprise everybody in the midst of inflation and drop down to actually undervalued. This was the period of maximum opportunity, and that was the period of maximum risk, right? Now, it lasted longer than anybody anticipated. But then it took some time to work its way through. And notice what's happened really since 1987. We've stayed at the overvalue. We get way overvalued, tons of printing. We stay overvalued, cracks, tons of printing. And look how far we are up here. This is one of the largest gaps that we've seen in history. Now, to put it in perspective, and the reason I point this out, if earnings stay the same, and the bubble bursts, what's worst case scenario? Well, that's 2225 on the S&P 500. We're currently, what, 6424? You know, that's a long way down. And notice, we actually went below that in 1974. Let's say earnings go up because of inflation and what takes place from that standpoint. There is a lot of downside risk in this market right now. And yes, I'm concerned about the money printing that's taking place, but I'm also concerned about deflation in the short run, because that was an inflationary period of time, but the market still cracked. And I don't know if it's going to happen or not, but if it does, and you have a plan to where you've got a decision point that you can exit and protect your capital, then you're truly taking the path less traveled. And the thing that I can say is, for those individuals that are out there that are just now waking up to this, and you see some of what you've been warning people about, the wonderful interviews you've been having with Ed Dowd and some of those others, then you're pretty lucky, actually, because if you have the opportunity here to diversify away at the greatest strength of a strategy. So a passive strategy it has its strengths and weaknesses. So if I go, well, for the sake of time, I won't go back, but you're going to do exactly what the market does, whether that's negative or whether it's euphoric and outside of all fundamentals and ridiculously expensive. And if you're fortunate enough to be able to exit at some point the strengths of a strategy and shift into something that can take away the weaknesses of that strategy, like a risk managed approach, then you're very fortunate. So the one thing that I can't warn people enough, I don't know if they can print enough money to keep us going back to an undervalued market, but I know there's several times in history, not just in US, but Japan, all of the economies around the world have reverted to the mean and beyond it at times in the past. And the maximum opportunity is when nobody else is in a position to take advantage of it. So that's why I believe that it is prudent to build up your emergency funds, have your resiliency, and develop an exit strategy or work with somebody that has an exit strategy so that you can play the game by the rules that are forced upon you. But you're going to make a move to the exit to protect your capital if these cycles matter. And I believe that they do. This is just another cycle that we've been through in the past. And the thing is, we've got enough information to be warned, but we tend to think that we're smarter than all of those dumb people back there because they didn't have access to information like we do. And we're not going to make the same mistakes. But history teaches us, if you study it far enough in the past, there's been golden ages and dark ages. And they just happen to be, you know, printing all this money, you know, has kicked this can down the road. And it may be an act of mercy to allow those people to find some implementation of a strategy that can help protect them if it's not different this time.
Probably isn't different this time. Just going out on a limb on that one. So, yeah, have a plan and have a strategy. You have to have a strategy at this point in time. You need the context. Yeah, you just have to understand really where we are, right? Because I don't think this is too harsh. Our media that most people get their information from doesn't just do a bad job of informing people. They misinform people, right?
Yes, they do.
They tell them things that are just frankly not true all the time, right?
They do.
And it's all in the interest of a narrative and having the right narrative. And the narrative is AI is the best thing since, you know, babies and sliced bread, and it's going to be solve all our problems. And we're going to go all in on that bet, right? And maybe appropriate context would be, you know, sometimes technologies do work out. And sometimes they don't work out quite like we think, you know?
That's right.
No, right? And maybe some caution. At any rate, we can cover that more some other day. But I think we're starting to feel the limits of what AI is going to cost and what it can possibly return. And people are just starting to get their arms, Paul, around the idea that, yeah, it does some cool things. It does some not cool things, too, in terms of giving people psychosis and making them lazy thinkers and students, like, effectively cheating. I had to put air quotes around that. But they're using a tool that requires that allows them not to have to struggle and think and wrestle and become astute thinkers and communicators. Right.
And that's what makes us better. You know, we talk about, I was having a conversation with the adults, the kids I call them now, of something that I heard that just reminded me, iron sharpens iron, right? It's not just the rubbing, it's the conflict, it's the impact, it's the sparks that come off of it that makes us better. You know, and I was explaining to them, and this is what I seek out in my life, is people that you're surrounded with that'll challenge you if you're being foolish, right? I don't want somebody to, I know you wouldn't let me, Chris, if I was headed right off a cliff, you're going to be screaming and yelling, throwing rocks, trying to knock me out to keep me from doing something even worse. You know, that's the type of people that we need to surround ourselves with. We don't need to be surrounded with people that'll tell us what we want to hear. That's not good for us. That's good for them. But it's not good for us. We need to be surrounded by people who will sharpen us and make us better and challenge our ideas, because that conflict and that struggle is what leads to joy and success and betterment of our lives.
Well said. So for anybody who would love to talk with Paul the philosopher and the money manager and or his team, please go to peakfinancialinvesting.com, fill out a simple form. And somebody from Paul's team will be in touch with you within 48 business hours. And the feedback we get is just extraordinary. People love it. And it's been going very, very well. So match made in heaven on that front. And so for everybody else listening, please trade safe, be well, keep your eye on the ball, and watch carefully what's unfolding in the AI space and with investors. That would be something to absolutely keep your eye on. With that, Paul, thanks very much for your time today.
My honor. Have a great day, Chris, and the listeners.